It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get tips for cooking with fresh herbs coming up in our gardens.
First, this Sunday is Father's Day, and throughout the show today, we're playing messages that you left us during the week about the greatest lessons you've learned from your dads. Here's Josie.
Hi, my name is Josie from Madison, Wisconsin, and I'm calling to tell the best advice my father ever gave me, which was to never make fun of people for things they can't change. Thank you.
We heard there from a listener named Josie. You can continue that conversation on our Facebook page.
Now, fathers, all parents really understand the challenges of balancing work and home life. That was the message from New York Mets second baseman Daniel Murphy when he spoke at a White House fatherhood summit earlier this week. He sparked a debate nationally when he missed the first two games of the season for his son's birth.
Murphy's desire to take time away from work for family is one shared increasingly by men around the country. In a recent Boston College survey, 77% of men said they wish they had more time with their kids, and more than half the men said that if finances permitted, they'd give up their jobs and stay home with their children.
Policies don't always align with that desire to spend more time as dads. A fifth of American men have access to paternity leave, compared to a third of women in maternity leave. And overall, American parents are the only ones in the high-income world without universal access to paid parental leave.
As we head into Father's Day weekend, U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez joins us to talk about what the Obama administration is doing to help working fathers.
Secretary Perez, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we've seen a big change in family and work life over the last 4 or 5 decades. More women in the workforce, more men staying home or juggling a job and family. Many families, of course, have two working parents. Have we learned lessons along the way, along that shift?
Well, I think you're exactly right, Rob. The workplace has changed. Economy has changed. Technology's changed. Gender roles have changed. This isn't your father's fatherhood. And we now live in a modern family society. And one of my concerns is we're still living by a lot of the Leave It to Beaver rules. Workplace flexibility here in the United States is all too limited for all too many people. My daughter recently graduated from high school, and I needed to skip a cabinet meeting in order to attend that. And I was able to do so because I had the flexibility. And the president said it was okay. But all too many people across this country, they have to win the boss lottery in order to take their son or daughter to the doctor, or take their mother or father to the doctor, or to go to their son's recital or their daughter's recital. And you compare the United States with other industrialized nations, and we're really far behind on issues of workplace flexibility. There are only a few countries in the world, Swaziland, Lesotho, Papua New Guinea, and the United States of America. These are the only four nations that have no form of paid parental leave in the world. And other countries have figured this out, and they figured out that you shouldn't have to choose between the family you love and the job that you need. And that's what we do all too frequently here in the United States.
Before we get into what companies can do, what the government might do, do we need a culture change, changing what we expect of fathers?
Well, I think we're seeing that culture change. More women are in the workplace, and I think that has helped to grow our economy. And more men are full-time caregivers. A generation ago, it was 1% of fathers were home full-time. We've moved up to 7%. And so we're seeing the culture change. And regrettably, today's policies have not kept pace with changing attitudes, changing practices, changing phenomenon. And that's why you see such increased stress. When I talk to parents across this country about the things that keep them up at night, this work-family balance is always at the top of the list, because too many parents are sending their kid to school sick because they have no choice. They have to go to work.
Well, the culture has changed. The reality has changed. But I don't know about expectations. You, on Monday, had New York Mets infielder Daniel Murphy. He sparked controversy. He spoke at the White House. But he had taken paternity leave very early in the season and got a lot of mockery in the sports world and beyond. Have we adjusted our expectations of fathers?
Well, I thought it was unfortunate that some folks chose to criticize a decision that he made. I thought he was heroic. The birth of my three children were the three most exciting and remarkable days of my life. And the notion that I would have missed it to be at a baseball park or to be at a workplace is unimaginable to me. And so I take my hat off to him. And I would note that, you know, part of the reason Daniel was able to do it is because in the collective bargaining agreement with Major League Baseball, he had the right to do it. And in today's society, all too frequently, people don't enjoy the benefits that come from collective bargaining because so many less people are unionized, and so they don't have those benefits. And he is really an example of the rights you get when you avail yourselves of collective bargaining. And I applaud him for what he did, even though I am not a Mets fan and never will be.
Well, in the absence of collective bargaining, what steps would you like to see companies take to make work schedules more flexible for dads or for parents in general, for that matter?
Well, we've seen a number of states take steps to provide for paid leave. And a number of studies in the aftermath of California, for instance, demonstrated that it had none of the ill effects that opponents had predicted. There have been studies of companies that voluntarily put in place progressive leave policies, and it showed actually for publicly traded companies that their stock value went up. And in fact, when you were the first company in your industry to do it, your stock value went up even more. Because if I'm a working parent and I'm looking at a new job, those are questions that I ask. You know, what is my company going to do if I need to take my daughter to the doctor or I want to go to my son's recital? These are real questions, and companies have recognized that this isn't simply the right thing to do, it's the smart thing to do, and those companies are getting ahead.
Now, these jobs that have flexibility that we hear about are often middle-class knowledge economy jobs. What about people who are working at lower wages, a business owner saying, hey, I need somebody at the front counter of my retail store, I need somebody on my light assembly line now, not at some random flexible time. Is flexibility a reality for those kind of jobs?
Well, and that's why collective bargaining is so important, because a lot of collective bargaining agreements have built in this flexibility in workplaces, retail sectors, manufacturing sectors, and elsewhere that give that flexibility. And so that sort of that the question that you ask, Rob, really illustrates yet again how I think collective bargaining can play a really important role.
Well, given that a lot of those workers don't have collective bargaining, probably aren't going to get it anytime soon, do you see a role for the federal government, for the Obama administration, and Congress, of course? What could change? What would you like to see from the federal government?
Well, there's a number of things that we're doing. In the immediate future, the president is hosting on the 23rd of June a Working Families Summit here in Washington, D.C., and we've hosted a half a dozen regional summits across the country. And it's amazing the attendance that we have gotten. It's amazing the feedback that we have gotten. And what we've heard consistently is this: we live in a modern family world, and we've got to get away from Leave It to Beaver policies. We're supporting at the Department of Labor funding to assist states that want to implement progressive leave policies. And again, there are a number of states that are experimenting. California and Connecticut are two states that have put in place progressive leave policies, and we have seen that those policies have been very well received. California and New Jersey, for instance, provide 6 weeks of paid family leave, and it's funded through very easy means. And so companies that were surveyed recently showed that while they had concerns initially, those concerns have not come to pass.
Is this something that the president can do with an executive order, or does he need to get Congress to pass it? And if so, is there going to be bipartisan support to make that happen in both houses?
Well, there was bipartisan support 20 years ago or so when the Family Medical Leave Act passed, and that has become part of the American fabric. And the challenge with the family medical leave is that it's unpaid, and that puts us at a competitive disadvantage with the rest of the world. This is really bread and butter for parents and families across America. And we want people not only to make enough money to put food on the table. We want people to be home at the table eating with their children. And as a result of the failure to pass the minimum wage and the flatness of wage growth, too many people are not at the dinner table because they got to work a second and a third job. And others don't have the flexibility because if they got to take a couple hours off, they get docked. And so they have to choose the job that they need over the family that they love.
You mentioned the Family Medical and Leave Act and the required unpaid leave. That also only applies to, I think, about 60% of workers because it only applies to larger employers. Would you like to see that provision expanded to include more employers and their employees?
Sure. I mean, we're working to expand the reach of the Family Medical Leave Act. And also, again, I think paid leave is very important. I mean, for all too many Americans here, the Family Medical Leave Act is effectively irrelevant because they simply can't afford to take even a day off of unpaid leave, let alone any more than that. And so people who are working low-wage jobs, they really have no recourse. That's why Connecticut and California and others who have put in place paid leave systems are really ahead of the curve, and I think that's where the nation will be. Change. I'm a civil rights lawyer and a labor rights lawyer. I look at some of the most important laws we've put in place in our nation's history, and they've taken time. This is the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It was first introduced in 1948, and I'm confident that there were people who said, this is awful for America. And we know now today that those people were wrong. It's part of the American landscape of opportunity. And I think paid leave is part of today's and hopefully tomorrow's landscape of opportunity for working families who are struggling to make ends meet, who need that flexibility in the modern workplace to attend to their most sacred obligation to be a good parent and also attend at the same time to their obligations in the workplace.
More broadly, you mentioned the minimum wage. We hear a lot about wealth gap, income gap in this country. Over the next few years, what do you see as the employment and income prospects for people, at the medium or lower family income?
Well, I'm bullish about the future for the following reason. I speak to employers across this country, including Wisconsin, and they are very bullish about the future. I spoke to manufacturers, for instance, in Wisconsin a few months ago when I visited, and they want to bring business back home, those who have a global footprint. They need workers with skills. We talked a lot about the skilled trades in Wisconsin. The average age, they told me, of a person in the skilled trades in Wisconsin is 59 years old. They're nearing retirement. There's opportunities for young people to grow into these jobs in the skilled trades that pay a middle-class wage and enable you to have ladders of opportunity. And we also have to make sure that we reward work by paying a fair wage. That's why we're fighting so hard to raise the minimum wage. And so many states have done so, most recently Vermont a few days ago, where the governor signed an increase in the minimum wage. 11 states in the last year have signed increases in the minimum wage. Wisconsin was once a pretty progressive state in terms of wage fairness, and I hope it will again become a progressive state in that area, because too many people are working a full-time job and living in poverty in Wisconsin and across the country, and that's not who we are as a nation.
Secretary Perez, thank you so much for joining us.
Great. Have a nice day.
We've been speaking with U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez about the challenge American parents are facing to balance work and home life. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's June, and a lot of our spring planting is behind us, which means it's time to start cooking. Herbs are already growing, and our next guest has some ideas on how to punch up our cooking using the fresh herbs we've picked right out of the garden.
Ian Knauer joins us again. He's a chef, TV host, and author. His latest cookbook is called The Farm, and he hosts a PBS show by the same name. Ian, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Well, herbs are starting to pop up in our gardens, and I know you're a big herb booster. What do you like about cooking with them?
Just about everything. And and I have to say that cooking with herbs is probably the easiest way to elevate your cooking. If you look at chef's menus, they're always herb heavy. And that's because it's really the simplest way to get extra flavor into your dishes.
What are the must-have herbs in your garden or in pots on your back porch or wherever?
Well, I think you absolutely need thyme, rosemary, oregano, parsley, and chives. Those are the five that you can't live without. And anything on top of that is gravy. If you have a place to put sage or lavender or tarragon is one of my favorites, then throw them in there as well.
Do you have a favorite from among that select group there?
Oh, that's so hard to choose.
You could only cook with one herb for the rest of your life.
Right. You're on Iron Chef. You know, they throw one herb at you. What do you want?
Probably parsley. It's the most versatile.
Parsley.
It can be used in stocks and soups. It can be used as a garnish. It adds a lot of flavor wherever you put it. And beautiful color, too.
I never think of parsley as having any flavor. Parsley has flavor?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and it's a flavor that goes well in a lot of different cuisines too. I mean, of course, the French use it heavily, but it's also used in Italian cooking, Mediterranean cooking, Scandinavian cooking, even Eastern European cooking.
So, when using fresh herbs, I'm always in a bit of a quandary if a lot of heat is involved. Do I get them up front so the flavor has a long time to seep in, or put them in right toward the end so I don't cook out the flavor? I never know.
Well, you know, it depends what you're looking for. So if you're making a soup or a stock, my feeling is that if you throw the herbs in there, it doesn't matter whether it's in the beginning of the cooking time or closer to the end of the cooking time, because they'll become a lot more subtle and they'll sort of blend in with the rest of the flavors. But herbs are the kind of thing that you can also add for a fresh note at the end, and I think that's where they really elevate home cooking. Especially. So if you have a bunch of herbs, I would, in fact, use them both ways. Let's say you have a big bunch of parsley. You can throw half of it in your stock in the beginning, and then once your soup is ready to go to the table, you finely chop some of the leaves and put them on as a garnish.
And we got to ask you, you sent us some recipes, and one of them is an herb-rubbed roast chicken. Can you walk us through that one and what you like about it?
Yeah, so the thing that is really intriguing about this recipe is that it relies heavily on bay leaves. The bay leaves are one of the herbs that we often, you throw one bay leaf in a soup or you throw them in a stock, and you don't really realize how potent they can be. But in this recipe, you grind them up in a spice grinder. You'll take that bay leaf that you put in the stock, you'll take it out then at the end because you don't want someone to eat it and choke on it. But when you grind bay leaves to a powder, they become a super intense flavor. And when you rub them on something like roast chicken, it takes a regular roast chicken and it makes it taste like a rotisserie chicken that's been cooking at a low, slow temperature for hours and has a lot of caramelization on it. It sort of tricks your tongue.
And it's also got some thyme in it, too, right?
That's exactly right. So the combination of bay leaves and thyme leaves you with a really deep, deep flavor. And it's one of the things that you wouldn't necessarily think would give you such intense flavor, but really does in the end.
So one of your signature Ian Knauer tricks, evidently, is to use vanilla bean with herbs. What and how?
Yeah, so I actually like to use vanilla bean in a savory application. So let's say you're roasting a pork loin or something like that. You want to dry rub it with a bunch of herbs and spices. I would throw a piece of a vanilla bean, maybe half a vanilla bean, into a spice grinder along with whatever other spices you have. Let's say it's coriander, cumin, thyme, black peppercorns, and then rub that on your piece of meat. Let that sit in there for a couple hours and sort of dry marinate, and then roast it off like you would normally, or grill it, or whatever you want to do. The vanilla in there really gives it an intriguing note, and it doesn't taste like ice cream in the end. The vanilla sort of like blends in with the other herbs and becomes this incredibly complex flavor.
And we've got that recipe up on the Central Time Facebook page. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
It's such a pleasure to be with you.
We've been talking to Ian Knauer. He's a chef, TV host, and author. His latest cookbook is called The Farm.
You and I both nodded when he mentioned choking on bay leaves. Maybe we'll have to tell those stories
sometime. I had a near-death experience with the bay leaf, I swear, but I still like them.
Well, the first time I did it, I cut up the bay leaf and put it in my spaghetti sauce. And, of course, it doesn't. Anyway.
It doesn't cook
down. We both live to tell the tale.
True.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This Sunday is Father's Day, and during the show today, we're hearing the lessons you learned from your dads. You've been leaving us your messages throughout the week. This one comes from KB.
Greetings. It's KB from Hoka, Minnesota. And this Father's Day weekend, the one that always comes up on a regular basis is the shortest pencil is more reliable than the longest memory. Thanks. Have a great day.
Thanks for that message. You can continue that conversation on our Central Time Facebook page. Tonight is the Midwest premiere of the documentary Citizen Coke, which explores the effects of the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling on Wisconsin and the nation.
4 years after the Citizens United ruling opened the door for corporate political spending, we talk with one of the film's directors, Tia Lesson. Tia, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, before we pick up the thread of the story, what motivated you to make this documentary?
Well, gosh, you know, you talk about Father's Day, and I was just thinking about my dad, who died in 2010. He died in a VA hospital, and he died in the care of these wonderful women who work for the federal government, you know, and they were union members, and they gave him care 24/7, and it was loving and it was kind. And, you know, in 2009, there started to be these extraordinary attacks against public employees, like the nurses that gave care to my dad in his dying days. And that happened all over the nation. There were attacks on nurses and teachers. And you know, we were curious about what was behind those attacks, myself and Carl Deal, my co-director and co-producer. And that sort of led us almost directly to the doorstep of Charles and David Koch, the billionaire extremists.
Well, you pick up the thread of the story with the Supreme Court decision. Here's the announcement of a ruling on a major case on campaign finance.
In Citizens United versus the FEC, Justice Kennedy has the opinion of the court.
First Amendment protection extends to corporations. Political speech is indispensable to decision-making in a democracy, and this is no less true because the speech comes from a corporation rather than an individual.
And that sets the stage for a lot of what you describe happening over the last couple of years. How big a shift was that decision?
I mean, it was astronomical. I mean, look, there's always been political spending in elections. There have been spending on corporations figure out a way and billionaires to spend money. But this just opened the floodgates. As we all know, we've all experienced that. And we've seen these flood of ads on the airwaves. But at the time, it was thought that the Citizens United decision was just going to affect, you know, the federal government and Washington, D.C. and politicians there. But we all know now that logic of Citizens United was extended to the states when Montana challenged the court ruling, the Supreme Court ruling in Montana that their corporate ban on elections is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court upheld it. And said, no, this logic of Citizens United applies to the 25 states where this corporate spending ban was in place, including Wisconsin.
And this opened the door. The Koch brothers, who you track in the film, were already big spenders in politics. How did this affect what they were able to spend?
Well, look, they figured out ways creatively, you know, to spend money for years now. I mean, David Koch, we have to remember, ran for vice president on the Libertarian Party ticket in 1980. I mean, he had these extreme positions. He wanted to get rid of the EPA. He wanted to get rid of the Food and Drug Administration. He wanted to get rid of Social Security and Medicaid. And he wasn't able to do that as a political candidate. But, you know, now he's deployed hundreds of millions of dollars of his own money, of his corporate money, of his other billionaire friends' monies. And he's essentially been able to move the Republican Party to this very extreme position. So he's been spending this money very creatively, whether it's through his political group, Americans for Prosperity, which he and his brother founded in 2003, or through this whole network and web of interlocking organizations that they're not super PACs, but if they were super PACs, they'd have to disclose their spending. You know, they're essentially front groups.
Let's give a listen to David Koch, excerpted in your documentary.
My brother Charles and I provided the funds to start the Americans for Prosperity. And it's beyond my wildest dreams how AFP has grown.
So beyond his wildest dreams, how Americans for Prosperity has grown. Let's start honing in on Wisconsin, as you do in your documentary. How much money came in? How big a force was Americans for Prosperity in America, in Wisconsin?
Well, we know that AFP had a lot of spending around, you know, initially supporting Scott Walker in his, you know, budget repair act, and then he so-called budget repair act, and then they came in very heavily around the recall. Look, we only know how much they spend when they tell us how much they spend, because so much of this money is hidden, and that's part of the problem. You know, Wisconsin used to have some of the strongest disclosure laws in the country, and after Citizens United, those laws were just, you know, eviscerated. So we know they spent, you know, millions of dollars. We know that they, you know, flooded the broadcast airwaves with ads. We know they sent out-of-state campaigners, not just to campaign, as they claim, on the issue, but, you know, they campaign on behalf of Scott Walker. That's very clear.
The 2010 elections after Citizens United, they were a big win for Republicans around the country. And it, particularly here in Wisconsin, they took control from Democrats of the governor's office, a U.S. Senate seat, two congressional seats, both houses of the legislature. They won bigger in Wisconsin than anywhere else in the country. How much do you see Citizens United and the Koch brothers playing a role in that win?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the Republicans Governors Association spent a lot of money on the Scott Walker race in 2010, and probably, you know, could have very well tipped the balance. We'll never know, because we can't take this money out of the elections. We only know that money does have an impact, and usually, I think 90% of the candidates who have more money win. That's just a fact. But look, it not only helps determine who wins, it helps to determine who gets to run in the first place. I think it scares away folks who otherwise might want to run for public office. For sure, it frames the issues. So David Koch put about $1 million into the Republican Governors Association, and the Republican Governors Association in turn spent about $3.5 million, or maybe $4.5 million, on Scott Walker's race. Koch PAC also supported Walker and maxed out on the contribution. So there's a lot of ways that the Kochs got money into this campaign, both 2010 and 2011 and 2012.
The argument from the U.S. Supreme Court on that ruling, and more so rulings since then, is that maybe you don't like money in politics, but political speech is the one thing that the government has to be as hands-off as possible on. Any attempt to regulate political speech is something the government should stay away from, and it isn't necessarily corrupting. How do you react to that?
I think when we talk about political speech, we have to talk about human beings who are speaking. You know, corporations, you know, they don't speak. You know, they're legal. They're pieces of paper formed, you know, they're not covered by the First Amendment. And I think that we need to clarify that. I think there's a movement afoot to strengthen the First Amendment, to make sure that it's clear that the First Amendment, you know, applies, you know, to individuals and not to corporate entities.
Well, following the narrative of the story you tell, there were the 2010 elections, and then there was 2011, when Wisconsin was all over national headlines for a few months there with the budget repair bill you mentioned that Governor Scott Walker and Republican legislators eventually passed and signed into law. How much do you see the Koch brothers' hand in that?
Well, look, I think it's clear that Scott Walker was doing the bidding of forces, you know, outside of the state of Wisconsin. I mean, what we saw, I think, and what we understood what was happening to be is was an attempt by the extreme right, not to solve a fiscal crisis in the state of Wisconsin, if there ever was one, but actually just to kneecap their political opponents and to take out the money that the unions were spending on the Democratic opponents of Scott Walker. You know, that's what we saw coming down here. And that's what we've seen, I think, in Michigan and other places where similar laws have been passed.
Well, they've said since then that lowering the power of public employee unions, dramatically lowering it to bargain, has saved the state money. It's saved school districts and local governments money. It has worked in a fiscal way. It has solved budget problems.
Look, the budget problems, as I understand it, were created in some no small part by Wall Street. I mean, every state suffered in the aftermath of the economic crisis, and it wasn't the teachers and the nurses and the correction officers that caused that. I mean, they were victims just along with everybody else and ordinary Americans, and Wall Street got bailed out. But public employees got targeted. I don't understand that. I know that Scott Walker, while he severely cut public education and public employees' salaries and benefits, gave whopping tax cuts to the wealthiest in the state. That I'm not sure how he gets away with that, but and how he gets away with saying that does justice to the education for Wisconsin's children.
A lot of the voices in your documentary point to Wisconsin as kind of a first domino, a test case that other states were watching to see what they could do next, how far they could go on issues like public and private unions, for that matter. Was that a fair evaluation?
Look, that's certainly our point of view. I think what we saw happening was, and still is, a state-by-state effort on the part of the extreme, right of the Republican Party to redistrict, to take out public employee unions, to really essentially super enfranchise the corporate interests and the wealthiest through these, deregulated campaign finance, and take out the rights of, working people to vote and people of color through these, voter ID laws, and taking out public employee unions, who are the biggest, contributors in the political process outside of these corporate interests. And they're sort of the bulwark, to these corporate interests. That's what we saw. And it's happening state by state. I think we just heard one of the governors say, if you want to change America, do it in the states, do it in the state houses. Don't do it on Capitol Hill.
We're talking with Tia Lesson. She's co-director of the film Citizen Coke about the effects of Citizen United Act 10 and the subsequent campaign to recall Governor Walker. We'll continue that conversation in a moment. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with filmmaker Tia Lesson, who co-directed the documentary Citizen Coke. The film explores the impact of the Citizens United ruling that allows unrestricted political spending by corporations in elections. It focuses on the Koch brothers' financial support of Governor Walker's campaign and its effect on politics in Wisconsin.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. 4 years after Citizens United, how has and is corporate money impacted politics in our state and nationwide, for that matter? And how about the union side of things? Are you a union member? How did it affect you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to our callers now. We've got Charlie on the line in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. My biggest question about the Citizens United case is that the justices who voted for it, namely Scalia, Thomas, etc., the conservative judges, all ascribe to a constitutional theory of trying to look at the intent of the framers of the Constitution. Yet the framers of the Constitution never viewed corporations as citizens or as persons, that they were viewed definitely as different entities. So I always wondered, how could they justify this hypocrisy between their stated goal of interpretation of the Constitution and what they came up with Citizens United?
Charlie, thanks a lot for the call. You got responses definitely in your documentary, including from Russ Feingold. What was the back and forth on that issue?
Well, no, the caller's absolutely right. This is a very remarkable decision for its lack of consistency and its break from precedent. And it's clear that the justices just went overboard and just did this overly broad decision. We were quite surprised to find out that one of the justices, Clarence Thomas's wife, is a Tea Party founder. And in the aftermath of Citizens United, her organization actually benefited from the decision itself. They got $500,000 in contributions that she wouldn't have been able to get before Citizens United. It was a clear conflict of interest. There were many conflicts of interest. Scalia and Thomas had both attended fundraising retreats that the Koch brothers had organized. Very odd that they weren't forced to recuse themselves on this decision. And one last thing, I mean, Clarence Thomas has actually been aided by the Citizens United organization back in 1991 when he was up for confirmation. Citizens United actually ran a $100,000 ad campaign on his behalf.
You mentioned the Tea Party, and in your documentary, you show rallies both from pro-union demonstrators during the Act 10 argument and from Tea Party counter-protesters, events organized by Americans for Prosperity. There was argument on both sides over who had a real grassroots following. First, the Tea Party. There were real people there. Were they a grassroots organization, or do you see them just as an invention brought about by heavy funding?
Well, we do know that the first talking points for the so-called, Tea Party were issued, decade ago, and they were issued by the Freedom Works and Americans for Prosperity, and this was not coming from the grassroots. Now, that's not to say that there aren't real people sitting in these halls and out at these rallies. I don't know that they know that Charles and David Koch have given so much money to these efforts. I wonder what they'd say if they knew that. I think... what might have been a populist uprising was hijacked by these billionaires. And I think their interests are quite different from these billionaires.
And as we saw demonstrations after Act 10 was introduced, there were accusations from conservatives and Republicans that this was kind of ginned up by unions, out-of-state people being bussed in to boost the numbers. You were filming on the Capitol Square for a lot of that. Do you think there was anything to that?
Well, look, you guys were here. I think you know the truth of that. Look, unions are people. I mean, corporations are pieces of paper, but unions are real people. They're made up of millions of working people around the country who've decided that they want to collectively bargain and over wages, over working conditions. I think what struck me when I was here was not just the union members that were out here, but the farmers and the students and the police officers and the firemen and the people that weren't even affected directly by Walker's attacks. They all came together in a pretty remarkable way. We also were struck by the number of Republicans that were out in the streets who felt really betrayed by what Walker was doing. People who'd voted for Scott Walker but didn't vote for that. Those are some of the people that we followed in our film.
But in the recall election soon after, Governor Walker was non-recalled, I guess not re-elected exactly, but very similar to margins to what he had won his original election in.
Yeah. Well, like I said, you can't really take the money out of the election, so you don't really know what would have happened if Scott Walker hadn't had a war chest, eight times as large as Barrett, if outside groups hadn't spent twice as much on his behalf. Who knows? What I do know is that money, not only helps people get elected, it helps frame the very issues that dictate our public policy.
And a couple of years after 2010 and those 2010 elections, President Obama won re-election. He won Wisconsin for a second time in a row. Does that show limits of the campaign spending on the Republican side that you're talking about?
I think it shows exactly why the far right wants to take out the unions, because it was really, the unions that delivered the votes and spent the money on behalf of Obama. So I think that's they're in it for the long game. 2012, sure, they didn't win. A lot of this money, didn't achieve their goals, especially in the presidential race. But look, they're changing the very landscape. They're redistricting. There are 440 billionaires in this country, and there are a whole lot more individuals. I think they've got to cheat to diminish our vote, and they're at it,
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Herman on the line in East Troy. Herman, hi.
Hi, this is Herman.
What do you think, Herman?
I think that our government is really in trouble with people like the Koch brothers. Unfortunately, I haven't seen her movie yet. But there's too many outside entities like this that are causing scoundrelism in our government. And I mean, it's not the left, it's not the right, it's all of them. We really need a grassroots change from the bottom up.
Thanks for the call, Herman. So after the time period covered in your documentary, are you seeing that kind of grassroots response, calls for change, anything that might take root?
Well, I think we know that hundreds of communities around the country have voted to take money out of politics. I think there's a whole movement, voters in, money out. This film nearly didn't see the light of day because David Koch serves on the board of a couple of public television stations. Our funding was cut for this film, and we saw 3,500 people come to our rescue, many folks from Madison and Wisconsin, to make sure that our film got to the screens here. And so I hope a lot of people come out, watch the film at the cinemas here in Madison and Milwaukee, and tell us what you think.
As you say, it was a rocky road. I was just going to ask you about the PBS story there. It's been a rocky road from production to release of this film. A lot of it is set here in Wisconsin. How important is it for you that it's now premiering in Milwaukee and Madison?
Well, we're very moved to be back here, and we showed the film at the film festivals in Milwaukee, Madison. The response was, you know, very touching to us. And you know, this film, you know, I hope that folks come to the theater, that you might see yourself in the film. We want to know what Wisconsinites think about this film, and we want to use this film to support what you're up to, you know, these days.
And what, as people see this, you mentioned they might see themselves, what do you want Wisconsinites to take away from the documentary as they see it?
You know, I think that it's all about talking and conversation, you know, and trying to figure out, you know, what our vote really means. I hope that people who maybe are so angry and so, you know, demoralized by what happened here in the last few years, want to reengage and understand that their vote really matters. And if their vote didn't matter, these billionaires and corporate interests wouldn't be spending all that money just to sway, you know, the electorate. So I hope folks, you know, use this film to reengage with the political process.
Tia, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
That's Tia Lesson. She's co-director of the film Citizen Koch. The documentary premieres tonight in Milwaukee at Landmark Downer Theater and in Madison at Sundance Cinemas.